one step in this long progress. It's been a team effort by us all the way. We're but part of the whole team that's worked so hard.
The shuttle era will come to an end, but they won't stop inspiring, and they won't stop being a part of the fabric of America.
We choose to go to the moon.
Alright, and then welcome everybody to another episode of the Talking Space Podcast. This is Talking Space episode 403 for the week of Monday, January 23rd, 2012. I'm Sawyer Rosenstein, and joining me tonight is Gene McCulloch. Welcome, Gene.
Always fun to be here, Sawyer. Thanks a lot.
And welcome as well, Mark Ratterman.
I don't know why, but it seems like there's a lot of stuff to talk about, and it's only been a week, so I guess we better get rolling, huh?
I do believe that we better get rolling, and who better to start us rolling than you, Mark? Why don't you get us started with our first story that'll be sure to ignite people's interests?
Well, I seem to have a lot of fun lately jumping around, so first thing I'll tell you about is the subject here. We're going to talk about, or I'm going to talk about, the WGS-4, the Wideband Global Satcom 4. It's a United States Air Force satellite that launched on January 19th at 7:38 p.m. Eastern Time. And towards the end of the story is that the launch was successful. They had communication with it from Dongara, Australia. And Boeing's Mission Control Center confirmed the satellite was functioning normally. Now, in between that functioning normally and the launch was some things that I want to tell you about. First, with the rocket and the satellite itself. You know, it's a lot of times in the past, I've heard about military satellite, you know, Department of Defense type stuff, and you think, oh, well, I guess that's something I'm really not going to learn much about because it's secret. Well, this is a comm satellite that's in a class of its own. The satellite itself is about 13,200 pounds worth of walkie-talkie. And it supports communications links in the for you amateur radio folks. This would probably be of interest. It has comm links in the 500 megahertz range of the X band and the 1 gigahertz range of the Ka band spectrum. They can filter. Get this. Here we talk about throughput to Mars Curiosity when it lands on Mars and the capabilities of communications there. How long it's going to take to send, you know, 8 gigabytes that are in a buffer from a camera on Curiosity. Well, WGS can filter and route up to 4.875 gigahertz of instantaneous bandwidth. It's wow. The first Block 2 satellite of the WGS family. It has a high bandwidth RF bypass capability in addition to capabilities provided by the Block 1 satellites. Depending on the mix of ground terminals, data rates, and the modulation schemes they use, this satellite can support data transmission rates between 2.4 and 3.6 gigabits per second. Get this, they got 19 independent coverage areas. They can be positioned throughout the satellite's field of view. They got 8 steerable, shapeable X-band beams formed by separate transmit-receive phase arrays. They got 10 Ka band beams served independently and steerable by diplexed antennas, 3 with selectable RF polarization. They also transmit-receive X-band earth coverage beams, and it can tailor coverage and connect the X-band and Ka band users anywhere within its field of view. There are 4 satellite operation centers for these wideband global satellites, and the support technologies. Oh, got to talk about the rocket itself. It's part of the satellite package. They got xenon ion propulsion system. It's 10 times more efficient than conventional bipropellant systems. They got a high efficiency triple junction gallium arsenide solar cells, deployable radiators with flexible heat pipes. They have 4 25 centimeter xenon ion propulsion system thrusters to remove orbit eccentricity during transfer orbit operations, and they're also used to perform orbit maintenance and to make required change of station maneuvers during the mission's life. The triple junction gallium arsenide solar cells are going to provide on-orbit power to the spacecraft, and the deployable radiators' flexible heat pipes provide increased radiator area, resulting in a cooler, more stable thermal environment for the spacecraft. If it sounds like I'm reading, yeah, you bet. Don't expect me to memorize this much technical information on something that I've never seen, touched, or worked on. But this is a press release from the United Launch Alliance telling us all about this bird. Now, the rocket itself was a Delta IV M+, parentheses 5, comma 4. The 5 stands for a 5-meter payload fairing. The 4 identifies that it had 4 solid rocket motors. The common booster core, the first stage, was a cryogenic conventional-type rocket that we're used to with liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. The solid rocket motors were 60 inches in diameter, 53 feet long. And just as a side note, when I started looking at the details of the launch, the solid rocket motors burned out at T plus 94 seconds. And I thought, gee, I'm in Lake City. I'm 170 miles away. I wonder if I'm going to be able to see this. It was a night launch. And I thought, well, my best shot for a good view to the south is going to be out at the airport. So our little quiet country airport, nice dark space, lots of open land. I got out there and looked off to the south. And I think I probably picked up the launch maybe 30 seconds, within 30 seconds or so of launch. And you could easily track it. And I was afraid that when the solid rocket motor separated that I was going to lose it, that I wasn't going to be able to see the first stage RS-68 engine that well. But I could watch it clear to main engine cutoff, or the first stage cutoff. You know, you hear about rocket staging, first stage, separation, second stage, you know, ignition. The second stage, there's, I guess, pyrotechnic charges on the interstage adapter that are fired. And then there's 16 pneumatic actuators that separated the first and the second stages. I think that's kind of interesting to realize that there's more than just a pop and that they do their thing. There's actually quite a bit of to the staging of a first and second stage. The second stage is also liquid and hydrogen, liquid oxygen fueled. It has a single RL-10B2 engine. The first stage was, I believe, manufactured by Pratt & Whitney. And, of course, now I can't find the exact details on that. But it's, to me, another little bit of trivia is what actually happens at liftoff. The RS-68 first stage engine ignites 5.5 seconds before liftoff. When they verify that they got a healthy startup on that first stage, then they ignite the solid rocket motors 2/100ths of a second before liftoff, and then, of course, there she goes. The main engine cutoff was about 247 seconds following liftoff. And then, of course, separation and the second stage burn, and there was a couple of second stage main engine burns, and then off she ran on her own in orbit, as I mentioned at the beginning of my little dissertation.
That must have been quite a view from your area there, Mark. I mean, you're about 3 hours away from KSC?
Yeah, drive time from Lake City down to Cape Kennedy is about 3 hours. And, you know, it's one of those things. If you're, I couldn't tell you exactly what distance here. I'm that far as the crow flies, 160, 170 miles. A front had moved through the day before, so we had, you know, this time of year in the wintertime, the typical weather pattern is the front moves through, and provided it doesn't stall, it moves through and you get really nice clear skies. And that held up for Thursday the 19th on launch night, and I just, you know, that was going to be, I thought, my best bet to see something other than the shuttle, which I've seen from my backyard, and sure enough, it proved out. So if you're anywhere within a couple hundred miles of a launch pad in Florida when something's going up, you know, get outside, get in the open, figure out where Cape Kennedy is in relation to where you're at, and, you know, watch the show. It's fun. It's interesting. Incidentally, the next, this was United Launch Alliance. Their next launch is going to be on February 16th. It's going to be an Atlas V. And it's going to be for the United States Navy. It's their Mobile User Objective System 1, MUOS-1. It'll be from Launch Complex 41 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. So there's going to be launches other than the NASA hardware that we've enjoyed so much the latter part of 2011.
Yeah, Mark, I'm just looking at real quick here some of the launch schedules. There was an article back in January 11th where individuals, there's one individual, General Anthony Cotton, who's the commander of the Air Force 45th Space Wing, was saying that they've got at least a dozen launches planned this year from KSC. So it's going to be busy over there. Even, you know, a lot of military stuff, but also, you know, the upcoming Falcon 9 launch in March and a few other things going on, including another launch of the X-37, the X-37B in October. So, well, you know, again, you guys are going to be busy down there, even without the shuttle.
Good times.
Yeah, I had the excitement of basically watching it from a computer screen, so not as cool as Mark.
Well, that makes two of us, Sawyer.
Well, you had one advantage. You had connectivity, so you could tell that the countdown was actually going, because with the little laptop I've got with kind of mediocre 3G connection, half the time the page was either freezing or it was so far delayed that I just had to go by my clock as far as knowing that, okay, I guess it's going and it's 7:38, so I need to be eyes sharp out on the horizon. And it worked out.
All right, here's an interesting one. Opportunity, the remaining Mars exploration rover, is going to actually be spending the winter, you know, hibernating a little bit, but it's not going to cease its science. It is going to be studying the rotation of Mars, as well as trying to see if it can figure out whether the inside core of Mars is liquid or solid. Now, that seems like a lot of work to do, and it seems like it may involve a lot of digging and a lot of fancy science. No, it's basically just going to be beaming back radio signals, and from that alone, they can determine all of that information. Now, that sounds crazy, right?
Well, that's cool.
Well, here's what they'll do. They'll beam those radio signals back, and using Opportunity's motion relative to the Earth, they will be able to get a precise measurement of the planet's spin. And they can actually compare this data, because there was another previous Mars spacecraft that did the same thing. And that was Viking. So they'll be able to compare it, see if it sped up, slowed down, or remained the same. But the other weird thing is, how can they figure out the core of Mars just from radio signals that are being sent back to Earth? That seems like a bizarre one, right?
Yeah, do tell. This is interesting.
Well, they're trying to study Mars's nutation, N-U-T-A-T-I-O-N, which Space.com describes as a smaller period variation in the planet's rotation. And based on seeing that, it can reveal if the core is solid or liquid. Basically, they compared it to spinning an egg to see whether it's hard-boiled or raw. You know, if it spins freely, you know it's hard-boiled. If it sloshes, it's raw. So that's basically what they're trying to figure out with the planet. Is it a hard-boiled Mars or a raw Mars?
That's an interesting way of putting it.
So that's an interesting one. So just based off of radio signals while it camps in its little spot during the winter, they'll be figuring out information about Mars, and that's a heck of a way to spend your winter.
Yeah, but it looks like, too, we're getting a lot of bang for our buck with these particular machines. They arrived on scene when? What was it, 2003?
They launched in 2003, and Opportunity landed on the planet January 25th, 2004.
Right, so they've been there since about 2004, and what, it's about 2012 now?
Actually, in fact, the date of the release of this episode happens to coincide with the 8th anniversary of Opportunity's roving on Mars. Go figure.
Wow, that's kind of sweet. And here's Opportunity again, still working and still chugging along and still wanting to contribute more to science. I'd say the U.S. taxpayer got their bang for the buck out of that.
Indeed they did.
Well, as we know, too, we had a little bit of a real interesting weekend in a couple of weeks, just last weekend, January 15th, with the reentry of the Phobos Grunt mission. If anybody's been following that, we kind of sort of already know what's happened with that particular vehicle. For some reason or other, it got stuck in low Earth orbit. It didn't fire its thrusters to put it on a trans-Mars trajectory, and the whole mission was supposed to go ahead and be a sample return mission. It was good to be landing on the Martian moon Phobos, and then return a sample of that moon back to Earth. Unfortunately, things didn't go out the way we wanted them to, and we had a reentry on January 15th. One of the interesting little theories was, and this was floated by, I believe, Vladimir Popligin, who is the head of Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, and he had this little deal that, you know, quote, shadowy forces, close quote, were responsible for this thing using other devices. In a really roundabout way, he was sort of shining the ugly light at the United States and the HARP radar over in Alaska. Russian scientists have basically said that's all bunk, and a lot of specialists here also in the United States have also said, you know, that's a lot of garbage. Well, an interesting little article got floated out there, and this is by an old friend of ours here, Denise Chow, over at space.com. And apparently, let's just say the conspiracy theories are starting to come out because a little bit of a development happened as a little bit of a follow-up story. Apparently, the U.S. military has removed the links to the Phobos grunt tracking data, which is a little bit out of the ordinary. Also, she was trying to get a hold of the Air Force to confirm everything, and they just basically said the final reentry prediction data is still missing from the U.S. military's website, where they normally publish that information. And the individual that Denise spoke with, according to the article here, said, quote, "I don't really have any idea why they withhold this information for Phobos Grunt. They've published the full reentry prediction data on, you know, other space objects so far this year, but we don't understand why." So this is really, really fueling this is almost like, you know, and I hate to use the analogy here, but this is almost getting to be like the Zapruder film of this particular mission. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens with all of this. But I think the most plausible reason for the reentry of Phobos Grunt, and the reason why the whole thing just basically crashed on us, it comes from a website called RussianSpaceWeb.com. The theory that they're saying is that as back on November 9th, when this thing was launched and it was going through its setup and self-checks and so on, the computer crashed. Systems were coming up online, and apparently the computer just couldn't handle the load. I will quote from the article here, saying that some post-failure tests apparently simulating some of the in-flight conditions revealed that the processor usage level in the main flight control computer onboard the spacecraft exceeded 90% of its capacity. Now, you know, you've done that before, where you've basically brought your own computer to its knees when you've gone ahead and you've opened up, you know, a whole bunch of applications, and it just starts bogging down. Essentially, that's what the preliminary finding is on this, that the onboard computer just got too busy and couldn't handle everything and just said no mas and shut down. So it's going to be really, really interesting to see what happens after January 30th, which is when I believe Deputy Prime Minister Rosigan goes to Roscosmos and says, "I want a report on what happened to all this, and I want it now." So they're preparing this report, and I'll bet you that this is going to be the prime cause of the failure, and it's not the HARP radar, guys. So just to go ahead and have our friends over there chill out and saying the U.S. did not deliberately bring this thing down. The other thing too is, why would we? We are beholden to these guys to get our crews up to the International Space Station. There's no real reason for it. So, you know, why, you know, monkey around with a science package? So, yeah, again, I'm sure they'll sort this all out. They'll figure out what happened, and I hope they'll go fly again. So, because the mission was really, really an intriguing mission, and I hope they actually do go ahead and shoot for Mars one more time.
All right, so we've made it once around the table. Let's make a second trip around. And since we started with Mark last time, Mark, how about you continue?
Okay, so here's a good question, or an interesting question to me living in Florida, and don't think that I'm that I enjoy other people's misfortune, because we sure get our share at certain times of year. But would anybody in the cold northern climates of the U.S. or anywhere in the world that that sees blizzards and snow and nasty wintertime weather, would you like to have a better weather forecast? Well, I've got something to look forward to for you. The satellite that is going to be launched, they're planning for 2014, is called the Global Precipitation Measurement Satellite. It's going to be an international satellite that will set a standard for precip measurements from space. It's going to provide next generation observations. Snow is notoriously hard to measure as it falls, according to Walter Peterson, the GPM ground validation scientist at the Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia. He says they contain snowflakes contain varying amounts of air and water, and as they flutter, wobble, and drift as they leave the clouds. Knowing how wet a snowflake is will allow the scientists to measure overall water content. Heavy wet snow can shut down a city. Melted snow is a crucial source of fresh water in many areas. Well, what's coming up is something called the GCPEX, which is the GPM for the G, Cold Season Precipitation Experiment. And the U.S. is going to be working, NASA is going to be working with Environment Canada, and they're going to measure light rain and snow in Ontario from January 17th to February 29th. It's a field campaign to measure snowfall and precip from both the air and the ground simultaneously. Now, the air part of it consists of NASA's DC-8 that we've seen previously in missions that the name comes to mind, Icebridge, where they're measuring snowpack over the Antarctic and Greenland and other places. But the DC-8 is going to be flying out of Bangor, Maine. It's already had a flight doing some preliminary work. This aircraft carries radar and a radiometer that are going to simulate measurements from space that will be taken by the GPM satellite. They'll be at an altitude of about 33,000 feet. They're going to make multiple passes over an extensive ground network of both snow gauges and sensors that the Environment Canada will have in the area of Ontario, Canada. Now, to me, the technical stuff, you know, when I was a trainee with the FAA back 30-plus years ago, I worked with some ancient old tube-type radar for tracking aircraft, for air traffic control. And it was interesting, you know, to think of that radar that actually had its roots probably in the 50s and early 60s, to think of what they can do with something on a satellite. Now, the actual region that they're going to be in is subject to both lake effect, snow squalls, and widespread snowstorms. If they get the opportunity, they're going to be flying over blizzards along the northeastern U.S. Now, the DC-8 is a converted four-engine jetliner. It'll be above the clouds. There'll be two other aircraft, one from the University of North Dakota and another from Canada, that will fly through the clouds, measuring the microphysical properties of the raindrops and snowflakes inside. They're going to have advanced ground radars that are going to scan the entire air column from the clouds to the Earth's surface. So basically, these multiple measurements are going to provide a complete picture of snowfall from top to bottom. And I think it's extremely interesting how this is going to work. And if anybody would like to follow this, I got two suggestions. One is a Twitter site, and it's called NASA_rain. So NASA_RAIN. They got a gorgeous website. I love their background image. The other thing that I'd like for you to take a look at and follow is a blog for this GCPEX. So take a look at the GCPEX blog. We can provide a link for that. And, of course, the NASA RAIN website on Twitter. I think you'll enjoy it.
Mark, again, the purpose of this is to go ahead and study the snow that's already on the ground. Is that it? And try to just figure out, you know, what's going there. Or again, I missed something.
They're going to be measuring snowfall, you know, live event, right? Snowfall, blizzards, light snow, whatever the snow is. They're going to be measuring it from airborne, from the ground, and they're also going to have, I would call it more conventional, but they're a little bit more more involved than a typical weather station on the ground as far as snow. They're going to be getting it on the ground, in the air, radar. When you think about what we hear about weather sometimes, that, you know, this was the hottest, driest, coldest, wettest year on record, right. Some of that comes from ground stations. But when you can put a satellite up there and get some measurements globally, and globally this is going to be in a polar orbit, so it'll cover from the Arctic to the Antarctic and every point in between as it goes around, they're going to get some very extensive data during the life of this mission.
Sounds good. And it sounds like, too, we'll get more, you know, climate data, and the more information we have about the place we live in currently, the better.
So let's head a little further than about 33,000 feet up in the air. Let's head about 250,000 miles away towards the moon, like two spacecraft did back in January. In January, Grail A and B successfully entered lunar orbit in their goal to study the moon's gravity field and to map that, as well as some other public outreach goals. One of those was actually coming up with a name for each of the spacecraft, originally called Grail A and Grail B, since they are twin spacecraft that will be working together. So they put it out to students, and they said, come up with some names for these two spacecrafts. And elementary students in Bozeman, Montana, submitted the winning entry. The winning entries, their names, Grail A and B, are now known as Ebb and Flow. The contest began in October of 2011, and they had nearly 900 classrooms with more than 11,000 students from 45 states, as well as Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, participate in this contest. The winning school was Emily Dickinson Elementary School, again in Bozeman, Montana.
Wow, and rather imaginative names for the spacecraft. Now, given what they're given, it, what the purpose of the two ships are. No.
Oh yeah, definitely studying the moon's gravitational field and mapping that. It's very convenient, the names, and good choice by those students.
Yeah, so I thought that was rather imaginative. Yeah, indeed. And again, NASA's doing some good outreach, so that's also the big bonus on this one.
Oh yeah, definitely, because that was one of the goals that was discussed during Grail, during a bunch of the pre-launch activities, as well as a press conference at STS-135. They were mentioning that they were going to as well attempt to try and get students and the public involved in the mission. And how's that for a way to get them involved, for allowing anyone ages 5 to 18 to try and come up with a name, with two names, in fact.
I believe, too, sir, there's another outreach mechanism on board the spacecraft now.
There is.
Yes. Okay.
It's called MoonCam.
Yep. Moon Knowledge Acquired by Middle School Students is the acronym, in which they can select target areas on the lunar surface and then send requests for them to study it, and then they'll get pictures back. And for coming up with this winning name, the school also gets to choose the first camera images.
Cool. And I guess from the trying to capture one's imagination category here, the groundbreaking occurred for Atlantis's new home at the Kennedy Space Center just this past week. Shuttle Commander Chris Ferguson, who is the last commander of Atlantis, was on hand, as well as Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll of Florida, and a few other folks, including a dear friend of this program, Andrea Farmer, and her boss, Bill Moore, who is the Visitors Complex Chief Operating Officer, were also on hand for that. They were talking, according to the article that I'm looking at here, dated January 19th, from Florida Today, and I'm going to quote. We will tell the story like no other place, and it's not just about the hardware. He said, today marks the start of a new era in which this magnificent ship Atlantis, which has traveled to space and back an astounding 33 times, will remain docked in her home port, displayed in all her glory, with a new mission to uphold, to inspire a new generation of space explorers who will take us to even greater heights. Lord, I hope so. And I also recall, too, that, by the way, there's a cool video on this particular webpage here, and I guess we'll throw a link link in the show notes about it. It basically describes what the visitor center is going to look like. We had Andrea Farmer and Bill Moore on Sawyer, I believe the aforementioned STS-134 shuttle launch is going to be like, and the way the orbiter is going to be displayed. The orbiter is going to be displayed essentially like she was literally in orbit. The payload bay doors will be open. The Canada arm is going to be out and deployed, and you'll be able to see her, the underside of the orbiter, and from an angle, she's going to be angled off as far as her display. It's really going to be pretty, but you know, I'm just thinking too. Atlantis just this week or this past week was moved into the vehicle assembly building, and Endeavour was pulled out to continue her decommissioning and her preparation to become a museum piece. And I'm just thinking about Atlantis sitting there just, you know, kind of sort of forlorn with her teeth out over there in High Bay 4, where I saw Endeavour when we were there for the Mars Science Laboratory launch. And, you know, it still breaks your heart to see them like that. And I'm hoping, you know, when I have the honor and the privilege of going to see this exhibit, which is going to be parked, I believe, guys, right where the old Explorer orbiter was. So it'll be almost just right up front as you're walking through, as you're driving past the building there on the road. I'm just wondering what I'm going to be thinking about, because the last time I saw that particular machine, she was standing upright and she was ready to go ahead and reach for the stars. I'm just hoping that some small child is going to walk into that center that is just going to be absolutely beautiful, and have that, entertain that notion that perhaps they could fly something like Atlantis, and perhaps we'll see them flying on a future spacecraft, and who knows, maybe the first person to set foot on Mars will be inspired by Atlantis and her sisters as they spread out through the country.
Alrighty then, so we've made our second trip around. Now we're going to make our third and probably final trip around the table with a couple of quick final stories here, and we'll wrap it up. So, Mark, care to continue with this round and our final round?
Will do. Does anybody know where their green sea turtle is today? Well, the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, United States Air Force, and the United States Coast Guard teamed up on January 6th to rescue 29 green sea turtle hatchlings and give them a little help in getting out to the open ocean. This was the last of 110 active green sea turtle nests that are on the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. And this last nest was about 50 days behind what would have been typical for the hatchlings to emerge from their eggs and go out to sea. The problem is that the sea temperature was lower than normal, and the concern of the people that are watching over them is that they were, because of the colder water temperature, that the little baby turtles were not going to get out to sea. They would end up getting washed back to shore. So what they actually did was, when they hatched, they took them out to sea themselves. And what they did was, the biologists were watching them carefully. They saw them break through their shells. And now let me throw a little background in here. The program started at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in 1986. They're tasked with the protection, conservation, management of endangered and threatened sea turtles. Now, they've got 13 miles of beach. They got more than 2,000 nests deposited by loggerhead sea turtles, between 50 and 100 of the green sea turtles, and this year a record number are in the U.S. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission issues a permit each year that allows the installation to conduct this program. So since 1986, watching over one of our own little natural resources. Now, the hatchlings needed some help, and that's where the Coast Guard came in and getting them offshore. They actually released them 20 and 30 miles offshore, and they had a little concern about some seabirds that were hanging around a buoy that was on the path of these hatchlings headed out, but they took care of warning them off with an air horn. So off they went, 30 miles out to sea, and their chances of surviving it are greatly improved. And I think it's interesting to see how the natural resources that area are helped along as much as possible by the folks that are managing them.
That is such a neat story, Mark. I mean, really, I remember too, this was just right after, I guess, the BP oil spill. They, as you know, that area too, they've got those sea turtles that kind of, you know, the mom lays their eggs and they kind of burrow in there. And they were afraid that because of the oil spill, with the oil washing up, you know, about ready to wash up on shore, let's get these eggs out of here. But what are you going to do with the eggs? Well, if I remember exactly, they ended up in a climate-controlled hangar at the Kennedy Space Center until they were ready to be put out there and let the little sea turtles go ahead and do their thing and get into the ocean. And that's what they did. They got a hangar that was just sort of doing nothing, and threw all the sea turtle eggs in there in a climate controlled heat controlled condition. And then when they were ready to hatch, they just put them out there and out there on the beach there, and they all did their thing. And these turtles would have been killed because of the oil spill. So, I mean, hats off to NASA, really, for going ahead and getting into this and trying to help wildlife. See, it's not all about space and aeronautics too.
Oh, and I just want to mention the source for this was kind of a heads up from Inside KSC. They're an unofficial Twitter page. This is not NASA, but it's Inside KSC. And they highlighted the article, which was on the Air Force Space Command page, afspc.af.mil. And the article that I was reading from was by the 45th Space Wing Public Affairs Office. Thank you, folks.
Yep, and thank you, Inside KSC, for alerting us to that. Great story.
Indeed. So we will go from turtles to another interesting story that we've talked about a couple of times before. And we're going to talk a little bit about the X-37B. So ready for this really cool classified information that we're allowed to tell you guys?
Let's hear about it.
Here we go.
Yeah, Sawyer, go for it.
Ready? Here we go. Well, it turns out that that was still classified, and I wasn't allowed to tell you guys any of that. So, yeah, that's been deleted from the recording, but... Oh, well, I guess I need to go to a backup story then.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I hate when that happens.
Yeah, I know. Darn government, SOPA, PIPA, blame all that too. So, anyway, moving on to my backup story here. We're actually going to move on to a story about science fiction movies. Everyone likes a good science fiction movie, right? But did you know that there was one science fiction film that was actually filmed in space? Did you know that?
Ooh, yeah, I heard about this.
Bet you didn't know about, most of you didn't know about it because it isn't released. This was filmed when Richard Garriott paid to go up to the International Space Station, and it was called Apogee of Fear. It's an 8-minute film that was an interesting film with a Russian cosmonaut and two NASA astronauts. And basically, he's promoting his film Man on a Mission, which is now out in theaters, talking about his trip that he paid $30 million for to visit the International Space Station. Richard Garriott being also the son of Owen Garriott, who was a former NASA astronaut. Now, the sci-fi film, basically, NASA has said, we're not letting you release this. So the interesting is, they have this whole first ever sci-fi movie filmed in space, and they're not allowing basically anybody to see it. However, somebody on this panel has actually seen this movie before. Yes, Mark and Gene don't even know this, but I have actually seen the movie. The entire 8-minute film.
Okay, no, I didn't know that you had already previously seen that thing.
Yes, it was at the 2009 Challenger Center convention, where he was the guest speaker, and he got to show it to us. I will only tell you what they are basically saying on the internet, because I don't know what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say, unlike the last story. So basically, it involves Mike Fink and Greg Shamitoff, who are on board the International Space Station. They're hanging with, Richard Garriott, and then he leaves and heads back to Earth. And so then it cuts to a couple days later, and they're starting to miss, Richard Garriott a little bit. And then all of a sudden, Yuri Lochikov, who's the cosmonaut, comes in and says that they're getting oxygen readings on board the ISS that are higher than it should be. So, what does Greg Chamatov think of as the obvious reason? Maybe it's aliens? But I'm not going to give away the ending. I don't know if I can, and if it does get released, I don't want to spoil it for anybody. But it's a very amusing 8-minute film, and it's quite entertaining, and if only NASA would allow it to be released. But it's called Apogee of Fear.
I thought they relented, Sawyer. There was a follow-up story to that, and I think they've relented and allowed the release.
There were talks of that. They were relenting it and going to release it, but they didn't actually announce when.
Okay, now, not trying to get you into trouble or anything, okay? I know you can't comment on the film or anything like that. Now,
and
but,
it's been 2 years since I've seen it, but yes.
Right. Now, dumb question. In your humble estimation, is there really, really anything objectionable on it that you could see that NASA would have a problem with?
Yes.
Okay, then we'll leave it at that.
Astronauts having fun.
Oh.
Not doing NASA work.
Well,
because basically this was like a little private kind of thing that wasn't... It basically wasn't really NASA sponsored. It was kind of like Richard Garriott basically being a sci-fi fan saying, let's do it, them saying, okay, we'll go along with it, and having fun. You know how, like, you'll see occasionally on NASA TV how they'll send back, you know, like little films of life on board the space station? It was kind of that, except they didn't downlink it.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the deal. If it was done during downtime anyway, who cares? You know, I mean, it's a neat little deal. Who knows? It might actually inspire somebody to, again, that seems to be the key word in the past couple of stories is an inspiration. It might inspire more people. So, you know, I hope that the story is true, that NASA has relented, and the rest of the world's going to see this. So it sounds like it's going to be kind of cool. It sounds like it was done very, very tongue-in-cheek.
It's a hysterical attempt, and although I have to admit, it is the best science fiction film ever made in space.
Because it's been the only science fiction film made in space.
Exactly. And on that note, Gene, how about you wrap us up here with your last story?
Sure. Okay. This we're going to get back on a little bit of the serious side here. Now, back in January 12th, the United States basically told the European Union, who is trying to go ahead and put together a sort of code of conduct, sort of a rules of the road for low Earth orbit, because it's getting kind of busy up there. So they're trying to work on this code of conduct, saying. It basically lays out how satellites are supposed to operate, because things up there are getting very, very congested, trying to go ahead and minimize collisions or possible, you know, issues that may arise because of these collisions. By the way, I'm looking at a Space News article dated January 12th that reported all this. Well, the United States basically said at that time, I don't think this is such a hot idea. The reason is we think that from a military standpoint, it may tie our hands. Saying that the article says here that the U.S. is basically a lot further technologically in development, and a lot of this stuff could be a hindrance to military operations. For instance, an example that was given here by Senator Jeff Sessions basically says, all right, fine, if you're trying to go ahead and have a stealth satellite and you want it to be stealthy, how does that fit into the traffic management stuff, you know, with communication satellites and weather satellites and things like that? So again, this could, the United States' standpoint was, this could be really, really a national security problem. By the way, just an FYI too, Russia, China, India, Brazil, they've all just kind of said, yeah, we're going to be in the car on this one. Canada and Japan, however, have jumped on the EU's bandwagon with this. It's also trying to – what really, really spurred this on was the China's little experiment in 2007 where it deliberately destroyed one of its own weather satellites, or defunct weather satellites. with a ground-based missile, which, by the way, sent more debris flying around all over the place. And we've already discussed the problem of space debris here on this program. Well, apparently now, according to a space.com article written by Mike Wall, dated January 17th, not just a few days later, apparently the Obama administration has done a complete total about face with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, basically saying that okay, we're gonna help you hammer this out, but we're also gonna try to go ahead and make sure that our military interests are also protected in this. Meaning that if we've got a stealth satellite up there, how is that gonna fit into the big scheme of things? Or if another country's got a stealth satellite up there, how is that gonna fit into, you know, tracking and all of that? But again, the code of conduct, I think, is okay in spirit, but there's still some issues that have to be worked out. So this is going to be something I'm going to be watching kind of close and seeing what really, really develops from it. I'll be watching this kind of close because the space debris issue is becoming it's something that I'm really, really trying to study. So we'll have to watch this and see what happens.
Well, you have no choice but to watch, otherwise you may get hit in the head with space debris.
Yeah. Or again, I mean, you always hear about the ISS having to do some sort of debris avoidance maneuver. It's almost becoming like a biweekly event. So this is, again, it's a problem, and we're going to have to watch it.
Alrighty then, so that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank everybody who joined us. Thank you for joining us, Mark Ratterman.
Good to be here as always, and can't wait for next week.
Same, and thank you as well for joining us, Gene McCulka.
It's been fun, Sawyer. Thanks a lot. Also, I want to go ahead and thank a whole bunch of people for their recent support. As you know, I've started sort of a solo endeavor, a sort of extracurricular activity from Talking Space here, called Spaceflight Observer. And if you want to go ahead and take a look at it, it's called www.spaceflightobserver.com. And we'll be doing some, you know, additional follow-up things and so on we've kind of, you know, that I can't either, I either we don't have time to do here or just some additional projects that I really, really like to work on. So the way I look at Observer is it's sort of Talking Space's little sister. So again, I'm kind of looking forward to diving in on that. But that doesn't mean I'm going to be leaving the microphones here. I'm still going to be doing some sort of contribution here, and I'm looking forward to making sure that this little organization I put together is going to continue. So again, folks, thanks for all the kind words out there on Twitter. There's, you know who you are. You're a really good bunch of people that had some really good positive input and positive feedback. So thank you. But again, I'm looking forward to venturing on with the other project, and I'm looking forward to continuing contributing here.
Once again, a reminder, Talking Space will continue as always with its regular Wednesday releases of episodes, so you can still continue to stick to us with that, and as well with Gene's Spaceflight Observer. So once again, I'd like to thank everybody who joined us, and as always, have a great day, night, evening, or whatever it may be, where you are.